Welcome back.
Everyone.
Yes. Okay. all of us.
Yeah. All of us. Okay. So we had previously discussed the topic of slavery, and we segued into two frameworks that serve as a foundation for perhaps ethics, and in particular for political authority. And we examined first and foremost, first of all, the tradition of natural law. And we asked ourselves, first of all, what is the basis for this notion in Western philosophy? And then in particular, from a Jewish religious perspective, is this a notion that we can endorse? After all, we are a revelation-based system. Natural law seems to cut against that. Is there consistency? Is there room in Jewish thought for this notion of natural law? We trace a number of outstanding thinkers and sources that indicated that really there is space for this. We saw some pushback in an article from Rabbi Meir Tursky, who suggested that even when Avraham Avinu argues against God's decision to punish the people of Sodom, on the basis of the claim of Hashofet Kol Haaretz Lo Ya'aseh Mishpat, how can it be that the judge of the entirety of the earth will not perform justice? It does not mean that there's some other objective standard of justice, rather that God is measured against. Rather, what it means is that, on the basis of Rashi's interpretation, is that God himself, in previous narratives in the Torah, had invoked, had operated with certain governing principles, and so Avraham Avinu was actually hearkening back to those. He was appealing to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's previous behaviors in making the argument on behalf of the people of Sodom.
What did he know about his previous behaviors?
So Rashi discusses in particular, I think it was the story...
There's net, right?
I'm trying to remember. I believe, I don't have the story in front of me, it was in relation to the story. I think it had to do with the story. I think it was Avram's own experience. I think it was the story of the four kings and the five kings in the context of that story and the way that God interceded there. I don't remember all the details. Anyhow, leave that aside for now. That was just by way of introduction. So we had some extensive discussion about that. What I'd like to move to now is an alternative theory that sometimes operates, as we'll see, in opposition to natural law, sometimes operates actually in conjunction with natural law. They're not inherently contradictory, but they can stand apart. And that's the notion of a social contract. Essentially, what the social contract does is it resolves the same fundamental issue, which was that toward the end of the medieval and the early modern period, there were the beginnings of certain fundamental questions that were being posed against monarchy. And this notion that the monarch, together with the imperator of the Pope and of the Church, had this notion of the divine right of kings. And there were accusations of abuse that were rampant, and people began, philosophers among them, began to push back against the notion that just because I've appointed myself the king, that might makes right, and that because I occupy the throne, therefore, must be that God stands behind me. Nonsense, they began to say. It didn't start with nonsense. They probably would have been beheaded, but right. Started with sort of more subtle questions that began to arise. And there, one of the so natural law becomes sort of one basis for authority, but in particular, when we think of government, especially the social contract tradition becomes particularly prominent, and so the argument becomes that the basis for legitimate government is in fact not because God said so, or some natural right of the king to subjugate his people. Rather, the idea is that the people explicitly or implicitly enter into a social contract, and by dint of that social contract, that agreement that they make amongst themselves as part of that larger agreement, they agree to come together to create a community or society that is going to be governed by certain rules, certain structures, and yes, certain individuals. And so even at a time of monarchy, the basis for the right of kings is not divine, but rather the agreement of the people, to vest the power in the people. And we can already begin to see that that is a radically different form of government, which begins to approach, of course, what we're familiar with, whether it be here in the United States or a democracy, or whether it be parliamentary democracy as we find in Western Europe, and so on and so forth. But this is already a very different kind of model.
There is a leader, but it's not necessarily just...
It ultimately derives the power from the people, which is a completely different... That's right. And so this is sort of an argument against tyranny, and this is a way to begin to limit the previously seemingly unlimited, right? Power of, right? We know that that absolute power, as the saying said, corrupts.
You see absolutely.
Right, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Lord Byron, right? All these, and we certainly know that. Plenty of no shortage of cases in point. Don't have to go very far. So where does this come from? Are there any Jewish analogs to this idea? Now, we're not going to find Jewish analogs necessarily in quite the same way as natural law, in part because, or we won't necessarily expect to find as much of a basis or a discussion, if only because natural law has to do with more universal ethics, and social contract is more about how we structure a state or a society, and of course we don't have an autonomous Jewish state and society for the period of the exile until much more recently, and so therefore, whereas natural law will get a little bit more discussion in Jewish sources because it doesn't exclusively or even primarily deal with the issues of government, when it comes to social contract, that really is the primary area or arena of discussion is in context of governance. And so therefore we'll tend to find less discussion, conversation about the foundation of government, because quite frankly, it doesn't really matter for the Jewish people, at least not in an immediate sense, until essentially 1948, or those who are thinking about these questions in advance of the founding of the Jewish state. But nevertheless, we'll see some hints to this in some discussion, and then at the end we'll hopefully conclude with a perspective on this from Rabbi Sachs, who has, I think, has,
so
yeah,
he's coming.
He's coming March 16th. Yeah,
coming
March 16th.
Oh, March 16th.
Here, Monday, March 16th.
Is he doing a tour here, or is he staying here?
No, he's coming in. He's coming in for a long afternoon and evening. He'll be here, and
that's it.
He's speaking to students. He's in New York. So it's an arrangement through and with Yeshiva University, but they're only able to, very limited amount of time. So he'll be speaking to our students, he'll be speaking probably to a smaller group, and he'll be doing something with the community. It's really exciting.
Who is it?
We are. Yeah. That
night?
Right here? Yeah, we're probably doing the gym rather than Josh. It's going to be pretty amazing. I'm really very excited about it. We're actually going to be having sort of an armchair public conversation on a wide range of issues: anti-Semitism, faith, the future of our community, state of Israel, a whole range of different really critical topics. So it should be really interesting to hear from range of all the big issues of our day.
He's in that movie, by the way. I missed that. He's in that movie that comes out Monday. Fighting Salt.
Yes, you mentioned. Yeah, yeah. I mentioned. Yeah. Good. How'd that go? Okay.
Better than I thought.
numbers wise.
Yeah, number wise. I thought we would be getting a decent crowd. Uh-huh. We were so late in the publicizing.
Right.
But I think I saw more people come in, so I'm going to say 70.
Okay. Sounds good to me. All right, good. Okay, so how does the social contract tradition develop in Western thought? So we'll do some sort of historical work. We'll work in chronological order and look at some of the key pivotal thinkers. But before we even look at some of the key names and personalities, let's just frame it a little bit. And the fundamental question is really going to be, essentially, what is the impetus for forming a social contract? We know that what's driving many of these thinkers is to move away from the divine right of kings model. That much we know. But when they come sort of tabula rasa, just to create an original philosophy on which social contract is based, in which it is rooted, question sort of becomes, and we'll flesh this out as we go along, why really in sort of an ideal society, or in sort of, if we were to ask the question, sort of, if we were to start from scratch and to organize society politically in a way that makes the most sense, that is going to be most effective, so what exactly is the impetus for choosing social contract as the way of organizing society? And we're going to see a couple of different answers to that question, and that different answers to that fundamental question will really result in very different visions as to what the social contract looks like, and we'll get a sense of some of the sort of the range of different kinds of government that we're familiar with in the modern period in particular will sort of emerge from the different answers that are offered to this question, and I think it'll become clear what exactly that means as we move on. One of the first thinkers, lesser known, back all the way in 1625, so earlier part, first quarter of the 17th century, individual, a thinker known as Grotius, and Grotius essentially... these are going to be all
non-Jewish.
All non-Jewish philosophers, and then we'll take a look at some Jewish sources after.
He's where?
But he is, I believe, living in England, I want to say. And so and he sort of formulates this notion. Many of these thinkers are, not all of them are British. We'll see some French thinkers as well, and American thinkers a little bit later on too. Some well-known ones. So essentially Grotius' argument is, he writes a book entitled On the Law of War and Peace. And essentially what he argues is just sort of the core foundational piece of this. And his claim, which is radical at that time, is essentially that is the notion of individual rights in society. Individual rights in society, and in particular, that ultimately the power of the government is really rooted back in the people, and that's because there is this notion of individual rights. Now, that's something that we sort of take for granted, and sort of as an organizing principle when we think about rights and individual rights, and these are just this is the backbone in many ways of American legal system, and so many of the Supreme Court laws are ruling on constitutionality of a particular piece of legislation will be rooted in the protection of individual rights. When we talk about common debates about wiretapping, about torture, about all these things, ultimately goes back to what are individual rights and how are those balanced together with sort of the needs of the larger society. And so these are some of the questions that we grapple with. But the notion that this is a touch, sort of one of the key touchstones of society, an organizing principle of society, is sort of something that we take for granted, and not so in the earlier part of the 17th century. And this leads to some very, very famous thinkers who begin to address this question. And the first of the most famous sort of crop of thinkers is an individual by the name of Hobbes. Might have heard of him. So Hobbes comes along, and in 1651, so just 26 some years later, publishes one of the most famous works of political philosophy, political science, which is the Leviathan. And in his Leviathan, Hobbes essentially adopts a very pessimistic view of human nature. And this is going to be, for him, the impetus toward the social contract. And essentially for him, life in a state of nature, sort of this natural state of being, is really, ultimately, not much to write home about. And his language is famously that life in the state of nature is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short.
That's life.
Pretty much it. That's what he claims. In fact, it's the war of all against all, bellum omnium contra omnes, and so, in other words, his claim is that in a natural state, basically, we're just going to war against each other, because ultimately everything boils down to self-interest. My self-interest at some point will contradict your self-interest, will contradict our neighbor's self-interest, and so on and so forth. And so when push comes to shove, ultimately we're going to fight for our own territory, our own rights, and therefore ultimately life boils down to this war of all against all. I like to cite a classic novel sort of brings this to life. Sort of the state of nature as the war of all against all is something like The Lord of the Flies, which is a classic novel in which William Golding essentially gives us these children who are, again, it's a tabula rasa. They're creating a new society on the island, and by the time they're done with it, okay, they're at war, right? They sort of lower themselves to a state of uncivilized barbarism, right? And there are murders, there is paganism, they worship pigs, and the whole island is up in flames by the time they're spotted by the airplane overhead. So for Hobbes, that's this very pessimistic view of nature. And so the goal of the social contract, the impetus for the social contract for Hobbes, is essentially a negative one. Basically, we're going to tear each other's heads off if we don't create the Leviathan. The Leviathan is the government that keeps us all in check and makes sure that, in fact, we don't simply devour one another. And that's really the purpose of the social contract. So for Hobbes, the purpose of the social contract is not so much to ensure or to protect our individual rights, so much as to ensure our very basic survival. And that's his vision. And that's in contradistinction to someone whose thought, I think, is much more animates and and sort of courses throughout the veins of something that we're familiar with here in America, which is, of course, Locke. And Locke is writing a little bit later than that, in 1689. And Locke essentially does accept, interestingly enough, he accepts a natural law theory. So he sort of marries, as we'll see a little bit, the natural law theory to a social contract. But his argument is essentially as follows. He doesn't believe that life is the war of all against all. He's not naive. At least that's what he would claim. Of course, Hobbes would differ. But he does recognize, or on the other hand, as opposed to Hobbes, his core claim is essentially that we do have naturally ordained, naturally endowed individual rights. For him, those are divine. For him, those are, divine slash some sort of natural law, which gives us a certain standing, a certain inherent kind of dignity. We think of the thought of Kant in terms of ethics, where Kant says that the ultimate sin is to treat a person as an object rather than a subject. We have to treat each individual as sort of endowed with a certain inherent dignity, and closely aligned with that is the notion of individual rights. However, we know that the reality is that even if life is not the war of all against all, there will certainly be individuals or scenarios in which my individual rights are compromised, or we'll need to mediate between your individual rights and my individual rights. Well, what body or entity will make sure that in that grappling, society is carved up in a fair and sort of, if not equal way, then at least a legitimate way, a way that we believe is ethically uncompromised or at least not completely corrupt. So therefore, for that reason, according to Locke, essentially the government is what he calls the neutral judge. And the job of the neutral judge is to ensure that everyone is properly taken care of and that there's a certain kind of fairness in the structure of society. And so essentially what we do in the social contract is we do give up a certain amount of individual rights so that, right, because we know that as soon as we have police and a legal system and a justice system and so on, right, there are a certain amount of individual rights that we sacrifice. But the reason that we do so is by choice, and that choice is an intelligent and wise one, because essentially what we're doing is we're all making individual sacrifices for the collective good, which then redounds to our benefit. In other words, when we sacrifice certain limited individual rights, that ensures that justice is served and that the really the preponderance of all those rights are appropriately protected. So whereas for Hobbes, essentially we're at each other's necks and we're just a bunch of rabid animals that seek to sort of claw at one another, and we will tear apart the very fabric of society, and so we have a Leviathan to basically be a police state, essentially, and to keep us all in check. For Locke, it's a little bit more nuanced than that, and some might say humane. And so natural law, on the one hand, endows us with those individual rights, and in order to ensure that the pie is sliced up in a way that is fair, and that there are basic ground rules around which everyone, if not respects, but is sort of coerced, in worst case scenario, to follow to one degree or another, that's where we have a social contract to ensure the protection of those rights. But you can start to see how Locke has not only a different approach in terms of human nature, but that the role of government and the degree of dominance of the government is very different. Although it's true that even for Hobbes, the social contract begins with the people, ultimately they cede nearly all authority to the Leviathan, because we're to be distrusted. There's no way for us to get this right, and so we need basically a police state. All right, whereas for Locke, there's something that's much more nuanced, and so there'll be a constant give and take between individual rights, because after all, the entire raison d'etre of the social contract is to ensure the protection of those individual, naturally endowed divine rights. And so you start to see that for a Lockean system of government, there's going to be much more give and take and much less of a sense of a police state, but sort of this sort of jockeying, this back and forth, in which we try to grant the government the legitimate authority and yet protect those individual rights. Now, there then, a little bit later, if we jump to the 18th century, there's yet another theory. And this is yet another famous thinker. This is Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Jean-Jacques Rousseau is, of course, a French thinker, and so has a very different perspective. And writing in 1762, he begins in a similar place to Locke. He actually writes, the famous title of his book is The Social Contract. At least in translation, the social contract. So we know we're reading the right material here. And essentially, what
maybe Lock and Club.
That's right. And so what Rousseau essentially argues is he starts from a similar place as Locke, but he ends up somewhere different. Because what he says is, yes, the goal of the government is to ensure individual rights, but what he claims is that without sort of this notion, and it's a very abstract notion, that's hard to sort of pin down or to understand with a real degree of precision. But what he says is that essentially a collection of individuals will not be able to successfully identify what their rights are or the best way to structure society. As opposed to that, what he claims is there's this some sort of collective notion of the will, the societal will, which is somehow greater than the sum of its individual parts, sort of this larger societal desire, which can only be construed and put forward in context of some sort of representative government, and that collective will is what sort of determines the contours of the state. Now what's interesting in Rousseau's thought is clearly this sort of collectivism, sort of this notion of the collective will, and without that you can't really get anywhere. And although it's true, as you said earlier, that the Leviathan sort of tends toward communism, or might say tyranny, right? Or could, taken to an extreme, could suffer that abuse. Here we really do see the roots of communism, right? That's really what you find in Rousseau, because essentially what you find in, as a sort of the core, some of the core philosophical differences between a communist kind of approach versus a more democratic approach, right, is essentially this point, that for Rousseau, the collective is controlling, right? The notion, even the lighter forms that we saw in the kibbutz movement in the early days in Israel, what we call socialism, not pure communism, and of course there are significant, not just nuances, but substantial differences along the way, there's no question. And yet at the same time we know that, quite frankly, some of the early kibbutzim worshipped communism. They celebrated certain communist holidays, and that Eastern Europe and Russia in particular was really a breeding ground for many of these movements. It's really very fascinating.
Yeah. I was reading today, I think it was a Commentary magazine, I think, about communism, and how even though a lot of young Jews, a lot of leftist Jews, mm-hmm. were part of that movement, and if any of them had any type of feeling towards, let's say, being Jewish or Israel,
yeah.
the collective or some kind of ties to Judaism, mm-hmm. They'd be thrown out.
Yeah.
They would be just. They weren't part of the circle.
Yeah.
So these Jews who were made to the kibbutz, they maintain their communism. So we feel communist, but we also feel Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're communist, Russia, let's say,
right.
you can't feel Jewish. You're
right.
either communist or you're not.
That's right.
And then they said, well, we're communist and we're also Jewish, so I guess Israel's the place for us.
Wow. Remarkable. Did you read Like Dreamers?
Oh, I did not read that book.
Yossi Klein Halevi. Right.
I actually knew him. I don't know if he remembers me, but I hung out with him a little bit on guitar in New York. So we're mm-hmm. in the same camp in guitar.
Okay.
But I didn't read the book. Maybe I should. I don't know. I guess probably you probably read.
I did read it,
but was it that book or was it another book that you wrote about? Maybe it was the other book. The subtitle was about how a few people recaptured Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
So
essentially, because what Like Dreamers does is it interviews and it follows a number of the paratroopers.
Part of that kind of like was how a group of captured, unified Jerusalem and split the nation.
Right.
And I disagree with that title. That's the title. They didn't divide the nation at all.
Right.
What he's
sort of suggesting is he doesn't really mean that.
That's not the front cover of the book.
He's just getting your attention.
Well, that makes sense. So much.
You didn't read it.
I didn't read it.
Okay, there you have it. Right. Anyhow, but I don't want to focus on the larger narrative of the book right now. What I do want to say is interesting is he depicts two of the many personalities whom he depicts. You get a real feel for what it meant to live on a kibbutz. They grew up in that kind of place. And there are descriptions in particular of one of the kibbutznikim who grew up in a real red communist kind of environment, and they literally celebrated Lenin like he was a folk hero. And I think the day that he rose to power was the day that they celebrated, and they had a whole procession, an annual procession, a day of celebration. They got off from school and they would celebrate Mother Russia. It's remarkable. So it seems so distant to us, and yet
I hope they still don't do that.
No, this is they can't. Does he describe actually part of what he describes is sort of the dismantling and the sort of the crumbling of this ideology.
Right. That's sort of how she came from those kind of families.
That's right. So you start, but you start to see some of this collectivist doctrine. You start to see some of the pieces of that in. See, he explores some of those. One in particular, I think a different one, but also a kibbutznik, but a different one of the different personalities. Anyhow, so you start to see where some of the different modern forms of government really emerge from different variations on how we are to construct why and how we are to construct this social contract. Now, among these three primary philosophies that we've outlined, Hobbes, Locke, and then Rousseau, of course, when it comes to the United States of America, and particularly the Declaration of Independence, and we think about Thomas Jefferson, who's the primary author, of course, of the Declaration, and more generally, the American system of government, of these three, I think it's fairly clear, it's quite clear, that Locke is sort of the godfather, conceptually, of our system, and in fact, the language that Jefferson invokes, that he uses, that he utilizes in the Declaration is highly similar, although is adapted, clearly, from the language of Locke. And so the language of We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights.
Right.
This is natural law, right? That among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. For Locke, this is the pursuit of property, and for Jefferson's the pursuit of happiness, and then there is a subsequent debate among scholars as to the relationship between happiness and property, and did Jefferson really mean to say something different, and so on and so forth. But then he continues, that's the natural law piece, so this is sort of the marrying of natural law and social contract, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form, and so on and so forth. In other words, essentially what the founders are arguing is that this Lockean version of government becomes the basis for the right to rebellion. Right? In other words, one of the ramifications of the different philosophies of government, and an additional reason that the founders were so attracted to the Lockean form of government, is that really, in contradistinction to Hobbes, according to Hobbes, and if you read his writings, it actually becomes quite clear, the right to rebellion is dramatically limited. He claims that the social contract is nearly eternal, that it implicitly lasts for generation after generation after generation. It's exceedingly difficult to abolish the social contract for Hobbes, because after all, we required an incredibly powerful central government in order to keep the people down, and these people were involved and would otherwise be involved in the war of all against all, really don't have the right to foment a rebellion, because after all, pretty much any form of government, no matter how corrupt, no matter how unjust, is quite frankly better than the alternative. So if you're looking for the right to rebellion, you don't want to turn to Hobbes. What you want to do is you want to turn to Locke. And so if the rights or the authority of the government is essentially drawn from the consent of the governed, number one, and the purpose of the government is to properly protect the rights of the individual, so if there comes a point at which this otherwise legitimate government, in fact, does not only not protect the rights of the individuals, but rather tramples their rights by refusing them proper representation in their taxes and so on and so forth, and all of the gripes, right, and all of the, they would say gripes is a demeaning word, right? It's something a little bit stronger, but all the complaints and the objections of the colonists against British rule. So again, if you had a Hobbesian kind of approach to government, no dice, there's no right to rebellion, but it's precisely because they adopted a Lockean view, right? Some might cynically say, they chose to adopt a Lockean view because it was conducive to the right to rebellion, but be that as it may, the point is that you start to see, right? And the rest is history. So you start to see sort of where these different approaches land up, and where they land is in very different places, even though they're all sort of unified social contract theories.
Still contract.
Right. Now, there's a lot more to say. Social contract sort of went out of style for a while, and then it came back in the later part of the 20th century among philosophers. There's a well-known thinker named John Rawls. John Rawls writes a theory of justice, and in it he describes many aspects of sort of an updated version of a social contract, which is a Lockean, but with some adaptations, and sort of his point is trying to check some of the possible abuses of power, and in particular sort of the notion of multiple classes in society, and how do we construct a government that ensures not only in general that individual rights are protected, but that classes are not exploited, sort of that it's not those who are powerful and have the most money and so on and so forth who then occupy the positions of power and then put into place laws that are really in favor of those classes of society, and that perpetuates a situation in which essentially you have an increasing divide among different classes of society. That's his concern, sort of a liberal argument, and not a conservative argument, really. And as part of that discussion, he describes what he calls the veil of ignorance. The veil of ignorance is one of his multiple thought experiments. Essentially, what he argues is that in order to create a just society, we need to take ourselves out of whatever particular situation we are or station in society that we find ourselves, take a step back, and engage in these thought experiments that allow us to think in a just and equitable way about the needs of the different groups within a particular society at that particular time. And so, essentially, the veil of ignorance is to essentially create a thought experiment in which I don't know, it's a theoretical society that I'm creating, and my station in society, whether it be economic standing, whether it be political standing, and so on and so forth, the connections that I have, the people that I know, right, to my degree of education, and all of those kinds of things, essentially, I don't know where I fall in that, because I'm creating a system that isn't for me, per se. It's sort of this veil of ignorance. And so he tries to sort of massage the social contract, the details of the social contract, in a way that it's going to ensure that there are lesser abuses that are in place. So that's essentially what he argues. So that's just a very quick overview of some of the key theories. And the question is, does Jewish thought have anything at all to say about this? So again, as we said earlier, as opposed to natural law when it comes to social contract, you wouldn't really think so, because it's sort of inorganic to our current state, because we are in exilic Judaism until relatively recently. And so you would think that these conversations don't really happen, and the truth is, to a large degree, really they don't. Nonetheless, what's fascinating is Judaism, although it does not have an autonomous government throughout much of this history, although there, of course, were local governments. There's the Vaad Arba Aratzo, which is in Poland and other areas of Eastern Europe in the early modern period. And you have sort of semi-autonomous Jewish communities. The Rama, during his time, had such a community. So you do have that, and you have some discussion as to the extent of the powers of the sort of the local autonomous Jewish community. But ultimately, those local organized Jewish communities did not have full autonomy. They ultimately answered back to the local government, and that we never had certainly that sort of that full-fledged sense of autonomy that we have in a modern state of Israel. Certainly, we didn't have that at many of these points.
So what would you say during the time of the kings, Ahab at the time.
Good. So if we want to have, certainly if we want to look at monarchy and all of that, that's something that Rabbi Sacks does, and you want to look at that. You want to look at the question as to whether or not there's an obligation to appoint a king. Right? And there's a classic debate about this, because on the one hand, the Psukim in Parshat Shoftim sound like it's a good thing. They sound like Som Tesim Alech HaMelech, that you're required to appoint a king. And yet, in Sefer Shmuel, classically, when the Jews ask for a king, it's begrudging, right? And says, really, you hate us, despise us, and really it's because you hate God, and so nevertheless, I'm going to give it to you, but it's begrudging, and you should just know here all the all the corruption, etc.
So
in order to develop a larger theory, you certainly have to look at these, and there's a classic of Arnes and Hedgen, which has a range of views with regards to whether or not there's a mitzvah, and then if you take a look at the classic commentaries, they're split on this issue as well. There's some interesting historical pieces to this, where you have, for example, Abarbanel, who was essentially the chief financial advisor to Ferdinand and Isabella, and then essentially lost everything in the wake of 1492 and was exiled together with the rest of the Jews, right? So Abarbanel writes very negatively about some of the potential abuses of monarchy, and he actually
kings and Shmuel.
Yeah, he says, and now Abarbanel ultimately claims there is no obligation to appoint a king, and he prefers democratic government. So there's sort of this. The last thing I'm going to mention this evening is that the truth is that it is possible that if you look carefully, there is one area of halakha which is not associated with our own sense of autonomy, but rather with our obligation to observe the laws of the land. This is what's called in the Gemara, in approximately six places in Shas, the Gemara says, Amar Shmuel, the Shmuel claims that Dina Zimachusa Dina, that the law of the land is binding. And so we, as Jews, in addition to being bound by the laws of the Torah, are bound to pay our taxes, and so on and so forth. All these kinds of things. So someone says, to cheat on my taxes, it's not just a question of ethics and chil Hashem, it's a strict halakhic problem on the basis of dina d'malchus adina, as if the chil Hashem weren't enough, right? Or being an ethical, decent person, natural law, as if that weren't enough, but it also happens to be usher in a more technical, immediate sense, dina d'malchus adina. Now the question is, and the Rishonim grapple with this issue, what indeed is the basis for our obligation to observe the laws of the land? Why is it that dina d'malchus adina? So if you take a look at the Rishonim, there's a variety of different theories that are preferred. But if you look in particular at Rabbeinu Nissen, at the Ran, he has one theory, and the Rashbam, another one of the Rishonim, Rashi's grandson, Rav Shmuel ben Eir, has an alternative theory. I'll read you the language of each one. So the Ran writes as follows. He says, V'chasu atosus, the Ran Masech Zedarim, the Chav Ches Amud Aleph. Famous, both the Ran and the Rashbam are pretty classic. They're fairly well known, and if they weren't famous to us yet, they're famous to us right now. So the Ran, claims essentially as follows. He says, "V'chasu v'tosos." He says that the Tosos wrote, "D'davka b'malchei ovdei kochavim," that it's exclusively with regard to Gentile kings that there's this law of dina d'malchus adina. Why? Check out this language. "V'pnei sheha'aretz shelo," because the land belongs to him. "V'yachol omar lahem," and he's able, therefore, to say to them, "In lo ta'asu mitzvosai, agareish eschem min haretz." I'm going to kick you out of the land. Right? So what is this? So this is not exactly divine right of kings, but isn't it a variation? Right? Isn't it a variation on that? All right? I own the land, and therefore I'm going to kick you out, right? If you don't listen to my commandments. So this, if not a direct divine right of kings, this sort of seems like a variation on that idea.
I don't think it can get more divine than that.
No, but check out the Rashbam. Rashi's grandson, the Rashbam, in Bava Basra, Daf Nun Dalet Amud Beis, another one of the Sugyot in which the Gemara invokes Shmuel's law of Dina D'malchus Sadina, this dictum, so he offers a different theory. And listen to this language and what it sounds like. Kol nisim v'arnonio, all the different taxes that are levied, umin hago shemishpatei milachim, and the various edicts of the rulings of the kings, shirigilim lahanhig b'malchusam, that it is customary to require, to apply in their kingdom, dinahu, is binding, it's law. Why? Shekol b'nei hamalchus, because all the members of the kingdom, mikablim aleihem meritzonam, accept upon themselves willingly chukei hamelech u'mishpatav, the rules of the king, and his and again his edicts. V'hilkach din gamorhu, and therefore it is a fully binding law, and so on and so forth. What's the claim of the Rashbam? It's not a sort of an ownership of the land or a variation on the divine right of kings. Rather, what's really happening here, according to the Rashbam, is what? Right, is essentially everyone accepts the rule of the king. Right? This is, right? This is, right? Okay, this is social contract. Right? When does the Rashbam live? Let's just put this in context, fascinatingly enough. Right, so Rashi lives from 1040 to 1105, and they overlap for a number of years. Rashbam is maybe late into his teenage years or something like that, roughly to approximately maybe 20 years old when his grandfather dies. So the Rashbam living primarily in the earlier part of the 12th century, late 11th to the 12th century, right, is formulating a theory of social contract, at least with regard to our obligation to observe their laws, the laws of the land, right? And this is how many hundreds of years before we start to see it, right? So if Grotius is writing in 1625, if Hobbes is writing in 1651, and Locke is writing in 1689, and so on and so forth, right? So he's essentially anticipating them by some 500 years. And it's not fully... What? It's just his running commentary on the Gemara of Basra. Okay. And this is not, obviously, a full-blown theory, we should be fair. He doesn't develop an entire philosophy of the justice system or the political structures of society on the basis of social contract. He certainly doesn't write a book called The Social Contract. He's writing commentary on the Gemara here. So
do you think these guys...
Full-blown. I just think it's fascinating to note that this theory of social contract in the Rashbam is anticipated, right? Anticipated by the Rashbam some 500 years prior. I think that's really interesting to know. Go ahead. Yeah.
You think they read? They read the
Rashbam? I don't think the Rashbam was reading very much. I don't know how much he had access to. In France and Germany, they were reading a lot less than they were reading in Spain. They probably had access to something, but it was not traditional to have sort of a fully rounded general education, certainly in France at the time that the Rashbam is growing up. I don't mean to say he had access to no ideas. Mm-hmm. Sure that there were things going around that certainly wasn't reading. But either way, this wasn't part of the... In any case, this wasn't part of the discourse at the time that the Rashbam is writing. So I think social contract, I don't think it's fair to say that it's a developed Jewish theory. I don't think it's fair to say that it's a Jewish theory in that full sense. But I do think it's fascinating to note that it's at least anticipated in its kernel form in context of Dina Malchus Adina some 500 years prior to its full-blown presentation in the early modern period. I think it's really quite interesting to know.
I guess, I wonder if Thomas Jefferson knew anything about the Rashbam.
What?
I wonder if Thomas Jefferson knew anything about it.
Yeah. Well, what Rabbi Sacks would say, and we'll come to Rabbi Sacks, God willing, I guess, next time, is that the biblical authors were suggesting that the founding fathers were rooted in a reading of the biblical works,
right.
And that their approach to politics is really, in fact, the next time we'll have to see is that he draws a contrast between different kinds of social contract, and he argues for a notion of covenantal contract, and that actually differentiates Jewish American social contract from some other forms that have been out there, and he says it with Tivusa, in other words, that this there's something in the biblical political system that has what to offer to our modern political system, and there's something that goes beyond the social contract. And that's going to be a thesis that we're going to have to explore next time.
Shkreach. Shkreach to you.